This podcast is a proud member of the LAM Podcasting Network. Find the network at largeassmovieblogs.com.
I wish you a merry, merry Christmas. I wish you a merry, merry world. I wish you a merry Christmas. I'd like to wish you a merry Christmas. I'd like to wish you a merry Christmas. And a happy new year.
Hello and welcome to a very festive edition of TV Good Sleep Bad. Joining me is my very own Christmas elf, but down here in the basement is Mr. Daniel Lackey.
Howdy ho! Gee, Elwood, you sure do smell all nice and flowery.
Obviously, if you've not guessed from the impression there, it's a South Park doubleheader. This week we're looking at two of the Christmas specials, starting with Mr. Hanky the Christmas Pooh. And we're also going to be going a little more twisted by looking at The Woodland Critter Christmas. If anything, South Park was the one show which really latched on to the idea of doing Christmas specials. The Simpsons obviously having claimed Halloween for themselves. And I think to this date, I think only Big Bang is the only show that will give them a sort of run for their money when it comes to Christmas specials. But as yourself, like, I mean, did you sort of regularly follow the Christmas specials or... you sort of dipping in and out as the sort of trend for South Park came and went?
My history with South Park is that my recollection is that I was there almost from the beginning. I did a little research on it. They debuted on Comedy Central in August of 1997. And I don't entirely remember how I got interested in it, how I started watching it. But I know I had been watching it fairly regularly about a month or two into it. So by about, you know, a month or two into it. So I got into it. And the thing is, of course, is, you know, South Park really kind of exploded almost out of nowhere as a sensation by the time, you know, Christmas of that year rolled around. You know, the show's viewership had doubled twice. And the kind of thing about that, those first two seasons is I kind of tapered off. I have some fairly solid memories of the episodes of the first season, but really beyond the second season premiere, I recognize like some of the episode names, but not really. I don't remember the plots. Yeah. The last time I really remember it watching South Park for any sustained amount of time was around the time of the film. So I didn't even realize that they had the annual Christmas episode.
I wouldn't say it's so much annual, but certainly they've racked up a fair few. I mean, we've got, I think there's about 8 in total specials that they've done to date. I mean, we're what, on season 20 or something of South Park now?
Season 19, if I recall correctly, season 19 just ended over here.
They've obviously not done one every year, but certainly it's the one show that they go all out, and it's often a real standout show. Like yourself, I kind of drifted away from the show when it lost its space on the terrestrial TV channel. Mm-hmm. It was shown on Channel 4 over here, and it had its premiere over on Comedy Central, which if you had satellite TV was great for you. But for us poor folk at the time, you know, those of us who only have 4 channels, which probably sounds like horrific to say to a kid today that you can only have 4 channels. I don't think they'd be able to like survive or get as creative as they used to.
I remember getting cable television at a very early age. Like, my dad was into all these fads, and we hopped on the we hopped on that particular train, I think, when I was 8. So the idea of having, you know, the horrible idea of having, you know, the 3 major networks, PBS and 1 or 2 or maybe 3 UHF channels, one of which always invariably broadcast in Spanish, and or broadcast religious programming. My memories of that, they exist, but that's very hazy. And that not, you know, I don't actually watch broadcast television anymore for the most part. I just basically, I cut the cord. I get all of my TV from like Amazon Prime, Hulu, and stuff like that. But yeah, the idea of having that limited a choice does sound to me like a kind of like a slow death of the soul.
Yeah, but at the same time, it's when you had those 4 major networks. I mean, we obviously had 5, which came in, I believe, sort of towards the end of the start of 2000. But again, unless you had a Freeview box that living in Cornwall, you couldn't get it. Which puts us in a whole different poor bracket, really, because my parents wouldn't get Freeview either. This box to go on, but that's, you know, that's a whole different thing, you know. It's that sort of thing, which is why you end up, you know, hanging out in the basement and recording podcasts about cult shows that most people have likely forgotten. But
right.
I still remember, I mean, on when you had Channel 4, and they would have the wonderful thing known as late night TV, and they would show like Godzilla movies or Kung Fu movies, or just like really random dreck, like our version of what a public access show would be over in the States.
Right.
You'd get like show up around the midnight mark. Right. And some of them used to be good, and some of them just used to be just like really bizarre. And occasionally you'd have something that shouldn't have never made it on, like Colin Malone's Sleazy Friends, which is one of the first shows that like basically interviewed like porn stars and showed like softcore clips of pornography, which again, this is pre-internet. You know, we had things like Eurotrash. We got excited about if we had like a sex scene in a film or you saw like a side boob or something. We didn't have access to the weighty amount of pornography, and it probably explains why slashers were so popular in the mid-90s as they were.
Over here, really, like the late shows, the late movies, and various local traditions like Samurai Sunday. Not really, that, which is not really kind of like a unified concept across the states, but kind of just like a catch-all idea, kind of like Breakfast with the Beatles playing Beatles music, you know, during a weekend morning. Samurai Sunday, you know, showing, you know, UHF show stations running, you know, martial arts movies during Sunday afternoons, or late movies and stuff that, you know, back in the late 80s, I discovered a lot of really interesting stuff, and that's really kind of where I kind of got really a lot of my interest in where I really started to pick up, you know, I knew I was interested in horror, and that's watching those late movies, you know, watching some of these cult stuff, that's where I really kind of, you know, made my bones, staying up to like 12, 1, 2 in the morning, watching movies like Dark Star, David Cronenberg's They Came From Within, It's Alive, and stuff like that. And we don't really have that anymore over here in the States. There are some of the non-affiliated stations will occasionally run like, it will sometimes like run like horror movies and stuff like that during the afternoon, weekend afternoons. And at least in the Chicago TV market, horror host. Our horror host is very much still alive, Sven Gulli. His show is very much still alive and thriving. But most of the stuff over here has been just, it's been replaced by the 24-hour news plague or paid commercial time, okay. You know, infomercials. And that was just, I feel kind of somewhat privileged as being a member of the last generation to remember what it's like to watch some sort of sleazy, very sometimes horrifically edited for content, but B-movies and stuff like that, watching or taping them off late night television, because we just really don't have that anymore.
Yeah. I miss the days where your VHS, your video player, and that was your best friend. It's like the magical day where you learned how to program it. So you could set it up to record rather than having to like wake up at 1 a.m. to press record on your tape.
Figure out how to program the VCR. You look at your listings magazine, TV Guide, Radio Times, whatever, you know, you look at for the listings and there you are.
Yeah.
You know, and you just start looking for some of the most bizarre stuff you can find and, you know, hope it's worth it. A lot of the times it wasn't, but you still kind of get a lot of experience that, you know, movies you'd heard of, you finally get to, you know, kind of experience for yourself. And that is very different. It's almost, I kind of liken it, you know, to the two eras to, you know, growing up as a teenager, particularly living out in the suburbs, you know, if there was some new band that I wanted, was interested in, but, you know, I had to go to the city, I had to hunt down, like, import singles, import albums, stuff like that. And now where you can just download any rarity off of eMusic or Amazon or iTunes, it's really almost the same thing. That sense of discovery is gone. I don't think the universal access is necessarily a bad thing. You know, there's certainly a lot of stuff out there that I'm very happy is available to anybody who wants to see it. But that kind of thrill of the hunt is gone.
I know what you mean. I still remember when the internet was to come out and you found out there were sites where people had listening after listening of all these obscure movies. Especially living in somewhere like rural, like Cornwall, where you didn't have like a revival house or sort of art scene where they would have people who'd expose you to these films and stuff. So I just remember those early days, and you just like find out about all these movies, and it's like then the quest to obviously go and find them and hunt them down. It just, there is something lost obviously in the art of, you know, tape trading and hunting down movies. And I mean, now the fact everything's pretty much available on demand, I mean, you'll have to go on YouTube or you know, like a Netflix or an Amazon Prime to find what you need these days. And perhaps some of the charm has been lost, but in some ways, it's nice the fact that it encourages you to hunt more, because, you know, it's not such an impossible task, and you're not having to like find something on bloody Cinefilm and then try and find a projector to play Cinefilm on.
Right.
Which is normally why you like took the like film studies in college and whatnot, so you could have access to the projector.
Yeah. We had some, you know, the community colleges here. You know, I know more than one or two people who took the film appreciation courses or joined the AV club or even for that matter in my high school just so they could watch some of this stuff that they'd somehow chanced upon.
Yeah. I mean, obviously we're in the festive season at the moment. For some reason over here in the UK, the TV gods, being the fickle beasts that they are, have decided that they're not going to just schedule in like Christmas special episodes of like Big Bang or How I Met Your Mother and stuff. They're just playing like regular episodes of the season where they're up to, which is a little frustrating. But I mean, obviously I have to ask, like, you, I mean, are there any particular Christmas specials that you like to hunt down every year or you make an effort to tune into?
Well, I have what I consider to be one of the first things I did when I bought a DVD player is I got copies of what I consider to be the two finest, at least on the American side, Christmas specials of all time. I know the British tradition a lot of time has more to do with doing Christmas special, Christmas-themed episodes of ongoing series, but one of the things we've always had over here, and I don't know necessarily if the Brits do this as well, but kind of like standalone specials.
I think like more towards the 70s, they were doing like the Warner specials, like, you know, the Morecambe and Wise Christmas special.
Right.
I mean, last year or the year before, we had a couple. I mean, we had, like, and it's mainly performers who are doing them. So we like Michael Bublé's Christmas or Lady Gaga and the Muppets Christmas, which was really actually surprisingly good, even though it was just basically one advert to sell a second album. But, you know, it's Muppets and Lady Gaga. What's not to like about that situation?
Nothing. It really actually goes back to the Muppets' roots.
Yeah.
But, no, go on.
I was just about to say, I mean, this year on Netflix, this is, again, where they brought across all these Christmas specials. I mean, we just had Pee-wee's Christmas special come across, and we never had Pee-wee's Playhouse here in the UK.
Right.
We had the films, but we never had Pee-wee's Playhouse over here, and I've yet to watch it, but I can see myself, like, being freaked out. Like, it's like a bad acid trip from, like, just the opening where they're listing people who are going to be on the show, and it's going on for 5 minutes. Like, you can go off, make a cup of tea, and come back, and it's still going.
Yeah.
But, again, that's really picked up some cool points this year. I've heard a few podcasts. I know Emily and Christina from the Feminine Critique. They named it as one of their favorites of this time of year. So we've got that, and we've also had Bill Murray's Christmas special, which I've yet to get around to watching, but I've heard mixed things about.
Yeah, so have I. I'm going to check it out. I have not had a chance yet. For myself over here, the two big Christmas classics over here are Charlie Brown Christmas and How the Grinch Stole Christmas. And I make a point to watch those two every single year.
Yeah.
Those are just like, it's not Christmas without those two to me. Another one that I don't own, but I like to hunt down on Netflix every couple years, is an early Jim Henson effort called Emmett Otter's Jug Band Christmas.
Again, this is another one that's really coming to vogue. There's that in the Priest Toy Story film he did, where the toys come to life when people aren't looking at them, but if they're not in the right space, they die.
Right.
And I know that a lot of people have been complaining because Disney, I believe, have produced a butchered cut, which cuts out Kermit the Frog, because they don't own the Muppets. They own the subsidiary groups of the Muppets, you know, like Fraggle Rock and Sesame Street and those ones. So they can't legally show Kermit the Frog because he's owned by someone else. So
So
they've cut those out. But yeah, I've heard good things about it. But again, it's one of those ones I've yet to watch.
I like it a lot. It is almost painfully of its time. Not in production values, necessarily. It's actually, I mean, it's nowhere near like Muppet Movie or Great Muppet Caper.
Yeah.
Grade, I mean, it's not cinematic grade, but it is very much of its, it's very well done technically. I mean, obviously it's the Muppet Studio, but it's just got this very sort of mid to late 70s American kind of hillbilly backwoods Appalachian vibe going, where the hero, the heroes, they have a jug band, you know, they play this sort of bluegrass with a banjo, and they play this sort of, I don't know if I would necessarily say corny, but I mean somewhat unfashionable music, and they're kind of the talent show. If I remember correctly, they try to get involved in a talent show to repair a house or something like that. And the big, their big rivals are essentially a band kind of modeled after Alice Cooper and Kiss.
Okay.
You know, big kind of glam, big kind of 70s hard rock with a glam.
Yeah.
With a bit of glam edge and a little bit of shock to it. I mean, you can definitely see like the Alice Cooper influence on it there. So this is one where I don't know if it really would have held up to audiences maybe that were born beyond maybe like the late 80s. More removed from, you know, the culture of the 70s. As opposed to someone like me, who, like, born in 73, remembers a little bit of the 70s fairly well, or even someone who was born a little bit, you know, early in the 80s and at least kind of has grew up watching a few things, so that the 70s culture isn't necessarily so distant and alien.
Yeah.
But I like it a lot. It's very charming in its own way. And it's a Muppet thing, and you know, it was really kind of that, and that was really the golden age of Muppetry. Really, where just about everything, you know, Jim Henson turned his hand to was gold. Really, the only thing that really kind of flopped at that in that period really was the Land of Gorch stuff from SNL, and that's because the Saturday Night Live writers, you know, Michael O'Donoghue famously said, "I don't write for felt."
Fair enough. I mean, it's funny you obviously mentioned in Kiss and stuff, because I'm surprised they haven't done a Christmas special. I mean, they've done everything else, it seems.
They
I mean,
haven't they've just done recently a Christmas done special? How have they not done a Christmas special?
I don't know, but every time I think of it, think of the Christmas special, I just instantly think of the Family Guy episode, a very special Family Guy freaking Christmas, where they have this cutaway, this running joke in it, is that Peter's constantly wanting to watch Kiss Save Santa, and that's the movie I want to really watch, but it sadly doesn't exist.
Yeah, I can't even imagine how a Kiss Christmas special does not exist in the real world, because criminy, back in the 70s, they just did. Yes, there, oh no, that's, sorry, never mind.
You got me all excited.
I found something called A Christmas Kiss, which is not, which is a romance movie starring somebody who was on one of the Law & Order movies.
You know, I could see myself watching that.
It's not the Kiss Christmas special. Kiss Save Santa, the Christmas show cartoon that never was.
Where they save him from pterodactyls by having Ace Farley like play a riff on his electric guitar.
Really, the only thing that's keeping, you know, I would say that should be made, but really, since Simmons and Stanley aren't talking to Ace Frehley and Peter Criss anymore,
yeah,
never going to happen, sadly.
But you know why it works with Kiss. You say it, and it will happen eventually.
Yeah, when they run out of money.
Let's not forget, Gene Simmons fired two of the band and replaced them with lookalikes. So I wouldn't put it, I mean, it's essentially just the Gene Simmons band, really.
Yeah, the Gene Simmons Paul Stanley band.
I think it's what you've got, like the Gene Simmons Kiss, and then you've got Ace Farley's Kiss.
So yeah.
Kind of like Buck Fizz.
Really, and the Gene Simmons Kiss, the non Peter Criss and Ace Frehley version of Kiss, has actually lasted longer than the what we think of as being the proper version. I remember when they got inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, Gene Simmons was all up in arms that the two people they now have in the Ace Frehley and Peter Criss makeup weren't being inducted. You know, that they were inducted, these two people, they insist on inducting these two people hadn't properly been part of the band since like 1978.
Yeah. Well, they had the same issue when Metallica were inducted. And was it their bass player or something who had been with the band like 6 months when they're inducted? He's like,
right. Not 6 months. I don't remember when they were inducted, but Robert Trujillo.
Yeah.
And the replacement for Jason Newsted, he was still very much the new guy, even though he'd been with the band for like 10 years.
I think the only other Christmas special one to see, bring up would be, well, there's two actually. The first being Blackadder's Christmas Carol, which I think is
I have not seen that in years.
Which is just a very, very British sense of humor to it. And I think this is from the golden age of British comedy. And the fact that here we have, if you're not familiar with Blackadder, each series looks at one of his ancestors, and it goes from medieval times through to the First World War. And ending on probably one of the most heart-wrenching scenes ever filmed, essentially.
Goodbye, I honestly would have to say, is probably the greatest series finale of all time. Particularly that final scene.
Yeah.
Which is so bitingly satirical and heart-wrenching. And it just really just hurts me to realize that the people that are responsible for that have now gone on to do... ABBA, Jukebox Musical, and Tepid Romantic Comedies.
Yeah. I mean, the funny thing with the Blackadder Christmas Carol is that, obviously, we're used to Blackadder. He's a devious sod who basically would screw over anyone in his pursuit of power. This is how it's gone over the previous four generations. We've introduced to the Scrooge version of Blackadder, and he's a nice guy. He, gives to charity, and he's the nicest guy, and he gets visited by a ghost, and he basically gets to see his past lives, which is just an excuse basically to dig out the old sets, as well as his future self. And he eventually finds out that if he'd actually been mean, things are going to work out better for him.
Yeah.
It's worth watching just for the fact you get to see future Baldrick wearing a thong.
That's right. Oh, God, I remember that. Yeah.
As he's
forget that.
I mean, obviously in the future, he's become like the Grand Admiral of the Galaxy.
Yeah.
It's like in this like 80s like glam rock getup. And you've got Baldrick, his little manservant there, who's just dressed in a thong and nothing else.
And I, if I recall correctly, that was Robbie Coltrane as Father Christmas.
It was.
Yeah.
He's basically the who's who of British comedy at the time. Well, certainly a lot of those, the guys who were really called like the punk pioneers. I mean, people like, we saw about Stephen Fry, which is really bizarre to say Stephen Fry is punk, but back in the 80s, I mean, he was doing revolutionary things, him and Hugh Laurie.
Right.
And you like looked at Rick Mell and Ade Edmondson when they were in the Danger Boys and stuff. And
right, the entire little clique of like British alternative comedy that kind of rose around, you know, stuff like the Young Ones and Blackadder, you know, those particular people, you know, people in the Young Ones, but also the great Alexei Sale, Tim McErney, various other people that would show up there. There's this one beautiful, beautiful, beautiful clip from a Young Ones episode called Bambi that I like to show people, and it's like, in this episode, you've literally got Emma Thompson, Stephen Fry, and Hugh Laurie before they became famous. I remember it's like a college, it's like a college championship type game show.
Oh, they go on University Challenge.
They go on University, and I love Stephen Fry's got basically the typical upper class twit. And his character's name is Lord Snot. I remember it's Griff Rhys Jones as the host. It's like, who is the richest man? Who is the richest man in Britain? And Lord Snot, it's like, it's me, isn't it? And the hilarious thing is that they last year they did the 24 miniseries. You know, they did the 24 reunion miniseries. Stephen Fry played the British Prime Minister in it. And when I was watching it, I was just waiting for the revelation that Stephen Fry's Prime Minister would be the same character from that one episode of The Young Ones.
Well, I mean, they brought
Prime Minister Alistair Snot. I would have loved that.
They brought Blackadder when they were doing the Queen's Jubilee.
Yeah,
and he was like, supposedly the organizer's like, do you think we're going to let plebs come in the grounds, leaving orange peel on the flower beds? But it's one of the better specials. I like it more than Back and Forth in Time, which was the last sort of special they did. But again, it's all about...
Was that the Millennium Dome one?
It's basically the one where Baldrick's responsible for killing the dinosaurs.
I haven't seen that one.
Okay. We'll probably look at it on a future episode then, if you've not seen it, because it classes really as a TV special, but
mm-hmm.
I'm trying to think of the Rowan Atkinson. The genius Rowan Atkinson is that it's all about how he pronounces words. He's not a slapstick guy. He's not a one-liner guy. His stick is just about how he pronounces things. That's why he's funny. And he's the reason why Blackadder is as popular as Blackadder is. And the fact he's able to adapt to, obviously, like some of the, like, the more archaic types, like we have Rick Mayall show up as Flash in both season 2 and season 4. Season 4, where he shows up as a biplane pilot just randomly, and he's just basically like this tornado that everyone else is like trying to get out of the way of, but Rick. He's just like throws himself in there, and he's just able to adapt. But yeah, the Christmas special's fun just because we get to see the different eras and obviously that future Blackadder as well. So
yeah,
I think the last one I just want to bring up quickly would be, and this was last year's big Christmas special, and that was the Black Mirror White Christmas.
Oh yeah,
If you're not familiar with it, it's written by Charlie Brooker, who gave us Big Brother with added zombies with Dead Set.
Dead set.
And here with Black Mirror, it's essentially a technology-based version of The Outer Limits of the Twilight Zone, the standalone stories. And with White Christmas, we got three interconnecting stories. And it gradually gets a lot darker. And by the end, they managed to twist Wizards' I Wish It Could Be Christmas Every Day into probably the most darkest song possible. Which is even worse because McDonald's at the moment are really using that song to drive their advertisements. So,
Ow.
It's got a bit of a darker edge to myself after watching that one, but
Yeah, that is, I love, I absolutely love Black Mirror. I actually, my knowledge of Charlie Brooker, actually, I actually kind of came into his stuff as, he was also, in addition to, you know, writing for television, he also, like, wrote about video gaming and computers.
Yeah.
And that's actually how I kind of got exposed to him. And then when Dead Set came along over here, I found out it was written by Charlie Brooker. And it's like, oh, it's written by that jerk who, you know, it's written by that jerk who said very wrongly that the TARDIS would run on Windows. You know, but I was like, and it kind of starts off kind of slow, but it really, I thought Dead Set really, really rose and really a great finish.
Yeah.
And there's some other stuff actually through Charlie Brooker that I became interested in, like some of Chris Morris's 90s stuff, like Brass Eye.
Yeah, Brass Eye and Day to Day, again, that's the 90s version of what the alternate comics were doing in the 80s. It's so punk, and the fact that he didn't care. I mean, he did another show called Jam, which is his really dark stuff.
Right.
And there's, I mean, just an example of what he classes as being a joke in Jam. You've got a woman who's like, looks like she's raving, but it actually turns out to be the light on her baby's life support system.
Oh, God.
And this is what apparently he finds funny. That and Kilroy Silk, who's like a... At the time, he was like a talk host. He was kind of like a Jeremy Kyle, Jerry Springer-style host. He was like very well-spoken. And until he decided to make some wrong comments about the Iraq situation and called Arabs a bunch of derogatory things, in which case he killed his career. But, yeah, they got a joke where he's basically going insane in a shopping mall, running around naked. We've got a woman singing "Loving You Is Easy Because You're Beautiful" while being hit on the ass with a space hopper. And this is what he classes as being funny, and it's soundtracked to Aphex Twin, probably the most creepiest music known to man.
Yes.
It's one of those shows that I feel that I should... if we have, obviously when doing the Christmas special today, I would like recommend we do for the next episode and just like drop you in it and just like not tell you anything about it.
Yeah.
See what came out of that one, but
oh yeah, there's some that particular little group of people, him, Charlie Brooker, Chris Morris, Armando Iannucci.
Yeah.
Iannucci is really getting a lot of notice over here for Veep.
Veep is just incredible.
Which I haven't seen.
Have you not seen it?
Pardon?
Yet?
I've not seen it yet.
Oh, Veep is one of my favorite comedy shows, isn't it, over here. It's intelligent enough to know that it takes time to build a story, but once it gets going, it's just absolutely devastating how good that show is. And Julia Dreyfus of Seinfeld fame is just, she really carries that show. And you wouldn't think that, obviously from her work on Seinfeld, that, you know, she would need someone to play off, but she's really carries the show on her own. And there's some really great writing. It's kind of like just the comedy version of The West Wing, but with less breaking.
Right.
No, if you've not seen Veep, definitely watch Veep. You know, you've got Christmas break coming up. Get the box sets out.
I will do that. No, it's one of those. I know it comes very, very highly recommended. And I like Tony Hale.
Okay.
So it's just one of those things where it's one that's taken me a long time to kind of get around to seeing, and I do plan on watching it eventually.
Yeah.
I haven't actually, for that matter, I haven't seen. Is it called In the Thick of It?
Yes, In the Thick of It.
There's In the Thick of It, and then there's the movie version, which is In the Loop.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, In the Thick of It. When they announced, obviously, the new Doctor, whose name I can't remember, but you'll probably be able to tell me.
Peter Capaldi.
Yeah, they basically made a fake trailer up, and they were showing footage of him in the thick of it, basically just like swearing and carrying on.
Yeah.
Footage of you're about as much use as a marzipan dildo, and they were like, "This is the new Doctor Who, kids."
This is the new Doctor. You know, we were laying. Me and my Doctor Who friends, and we're laying bets on how long it would take the new Doctor to say "fuckity bye."
So, I mean, is there any other sort of festive specials that you want to recommend to the good folks?
I have not seen them in a long time, but there's always also the stop motion Rankin Bass, Frosty the Snowman,
yeah,
and Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. When it comes to these the specials, a lot of these specials, I am a classicist. I like the old reliables.
You know what you like.
They're part of my childhood. You know, I grew up watching this stuff, and you know, that's to me Christmas. I mean, not that I mind watching, you know, different things, you know, obviously, or new things. But you know, that's, you know, Christmas, I think, in a big way, is kind of about nostalgia.
Yeah.
And you know, that's why I like to kind of go back to some of my old reliables. I mean, not that there isn't new stuff, not that there isn't really good stuff, you know, new being done, but, you know, it's just, like I said, it's like kind of like comfort food.
Yeah. I think that's what you need at Christmas. You basically have this, like, mental checklist of things you want to achieve and stuff, and it's like, one is to, like, basically consume anything that can be eaten in the house, and two, like, in some state of a food coma, and it's that time where you've basically got freedom to, like, do this sort of, like, Roman-style style of gluttony. And I mean, you know, you wake up and you have a couple of beers and then, you know, like a sherry because it's Christmas, and you know, a Jack Daniels and stuff because, you know, your dad wants to have a spirit and stuff, and you know, maybe a couple more beers and stuff, and then some breakfast.
Yeah,
that's the way to start the day.
Really, it's almost like it's almost like a Roman style bacchanalia.
Yeah,
without the orgy. You know,
I don't want to be there. That's gonna be an orgy.
You know, and really, and I don't know what other holidays you have throughout November.
I mean, we don't obviously have Thanksgiving. We don't have that warm up roast that you guys do. We have the traditional Sunday roast,
right?
Which I guess is our warm up for the big day. But we don't have like Thanksgiving. You have like essentially just. In layman's terms, certainly from the British point of view, it looks like you have two Christmases pretty much back to back. So,
almost. I mean, it's Thanksgiving in many ways is it's Christmas with without the presents and a lot more racism. You know, so it's a time to yell at your to argue with your family members who don't agree with you politically. About Native American genocide. It's really it's the happiest time of the American calendar, really. Really. But no, over here, if you can think of gluttony as being a distinctly American sin, we basically have kind of like a holiday season that really lasts from about Halloween straight, almost 2 months straight, that literally lasts from, like, you know, Halloween to New Year's. And, you know, we spend, that's why for so many people, particularly in America, the traditional New Year's Eve, the new traditional New Year's resolution is to lose weight. Because you have spent the last month and a half devouring every single thing that looks like it might be edible.
That's the thing. It's like,
there is
eat some crap at Christmas. It's
there is stuff that you would never, ever eat at any other time of the year. I cannot think of a reason anybody would ever eat cranberry sauce, let alone at Thanksgiving. But this is what we do.
Yeah.
You know, it's really kind of like a time for, like, trying to satiate that, you know, unknowable hunger that lives deep inside of you.
We don't really have cranberries. We have, I guess the British alternative would be that we have dates, which is something that gets bought. It's like this very old-timey thing that you have dates, which is like a sticky fruit that you have like one toothpick in this whole box that I guarantee you will lose after 5 minutes after that box is open. That normally just sits under the tree, getting warm and sticky, and more unedible because no one wants dates. It's
right.
You only bought it because it's tradition. The same as, like, if you buy the year we bought, like, sugar mice, and again, we put them too close to the tree, and we woke up Christmas Day to find they melted, so.
You basically this sort of, you know, mutant hybrid sort of thing from a
with Cronenberg the decorations.
Yes. It's a Cronenberg Christmas.
That's what he needs to get on to next year. Yeah, we need Cronenberg Christmas. Either Rick and Morty needs to do it, or Cronenberg himself needs to step up and give us Cronenberg Christmas.
Yeah.
I suppose this is the best time as any, in fact, to move on to our first film this evening, or first TV special this evening. We're obviously going to start with Mr. Hankey the Christmas Pooh, the first Christmas special, if you're not obviously counting the original Spirit of Christmas short films, which were Jesus vs. Frosty and Jesus vs. Santa, which Matt and Trey put out under their original production company, which again would in turn be used to give us the likes of Cannibal the Musical, Orgasmo, and the Book of Orgasmo. The original shorts, which would obviously lead us on to the main show being put out, are incredibly rough. I don't know if you've seen them, Lackey, or
I have seen them. They are on YouTube. I ultimately, when deciding to go with Mr. Hankey, I went and revisited. I think I had seen them back in the 90s, but they are on YouTube now, and I went and I watched them both.
I still remember that. I mean, they were the sort of thing that shows up when you were doing tape trading, that they would come through. And for a while, they were like a hot item. And I remember getting a tape, and it had both of them on. But in between, you had The End of the Beast, which is like a French art house version of Beauty and the Beast, which has a really sort of sticky ending, should we say, in polite terms. So you had these two weird cartoons and some woman covered in something that's not snow jammed between it, which... That was always the thing about tape trading. You never knew essentially what you get. You'd always get like bits and pieces of things more often than not, or like ghost things where the things have been taped over. But I still remember seeing these originally, and they're very crude. The language is certainly a lot more ruder than the actual series. And when it obviously came to time to do the first Christmas special, as you said on our previous show, this was sort of a real water cooler moment.
It in America, and I don't think we recorded this bit, but I think you and I were talking before we actually started recording, South Park. South Park was almost like an overnight sensation. It debuted in August of 97, and it had kind of reached a point by December of 97, mid-December, which is when Mr. Hankey aired. It had become something almost, this was, I think, kind of the tipping point where original scripted programming on cable really started to become something that people started paying attention to. Really, the other big watershed for cable scripted programming also debuted in 97, Oz. But it was one of these things where Comedy Central promoted the crap out of the show. If you had watched Comedy Central for any amount of time, and at that point, Comedy Central was kind of like, Comedy Central was not kind of like the juggernaut it is today.
Yeah.
It was really this 97, 96 and 97 between South Park and The Daily Show. And The Daily Show, even when The Daily Show debuted, it really didn't took Daily Show, I think, about a year or two to catch on. When Craig Kilborn left and Jon Stewart took over. But this was, if you watched it, they had all these various kind of weird things on Comedy Central, like I think they were still running MST3K, Mystery Science Theater. I think they were still running it on Comedy Central at that point. But if you watched Comedy Central for any amount of time, you saw... and they Comedy Central really did promote it in a way very contrary to what Parker and Stone wanted. I remember every single season one promo produced by Comedy Central ended with a clip of Kenny's death, and saying, "And Kenny dies," which I know really pissed Parker and Stone off. Because it was supposed to be a recurring joke, but it wasn't supposed to be a constant recurring joke, and it wasn't supposed to be something that they put that much focus on. But it really was a brilliant marketing stroke on Comedy Central's part, because it really, really established in the mind before you even watched a single episode of it as a place, as a space, where the ordinary rules did not apply, even by the standards of animation. This was a place where just any sort of incredibly messed up thing could happen.
Yeah, and certainly just obviously looking at the first season. I mean, this is episode 9 in season 1 that this episode appears. So, up until this point, we've had Carmen getting an anal probe, becoming morbidly obese. We've had an elephant making love to a pig. Kenny being killed by death. And having to deal with Stan's suicidal grandma. We've had starving Marvin.
Good old starving Marvin, that was, yeah.
And we've obviously had the Big Gay Owl's Big Gay Boat Ride, which most famously featured George Clooney as Spanky the dog.
Yep.
Who doesn't speak and just makes dog noises.
Yeah. And I mean, it was like... And the turnover for a South Park episode, while not quite as short as it is today, South Park episodes are... There's even a documentary about how South Park is made, and it's a week from writing to air. It literally is a seat of the pants, almost a seat of a pants type operation, and it was still done very quickly back then, which meant that it really had, by the time these middle season one episodes were being made, it had started to become a bit of a phenomenon. It had started to catch on.
Yeah.
People's expectations of what to expect from a South Park episode, you know, I mean, they screw with that here by faking you out thinking Kenny's going to die a couple times.
Yeah,
you know?
That was...
And by February, when season one resumes, you know, they're in a place where they can put in cameo appearances by people who are recognizable. You know, I mean, not that Natasha Hensridge was a huge star back then.
Let's not forget.
The audience of South Park would have known who she was, you know. And then having, in the very next episode, having Robert Smith of The Cure come on and play himself. That's really kind of like the trajectory of South Park. You see it in that entire first season, where they're able to, by the middle of the season, they're able to react to how much of a phenomenon they're becoming, which really I thought has always been one of the benefits, one of the things that's gotten its favor. It can really, really be, I guess, topical, not necessarily politically, but just react to the culture a lot quicker than a lot of other shows can. But yeah, it's this was the moment at which, by this point, this was, you know, I was living at home at this time. This was, I watched this episode with my mother.
Oh, I'm sure she'd appreciate that.
You know, that's how much of a phenomenon it had become by that point. Its ratings were, I mean, they were a drop in the bucket by general, you know, by general standards. I mean, I think about 4.5 million people, 5 million people watched, watched Mr. Hankey. But I mean, that was phenomenal by cable network, by cable standards. And this was the thing where, you know, I went to my hairdresser after Mr. Hankey aired. My hairdresser was like, "Have you seen this thing on TV called South Park? They had him playing with a piece of poo." And I'm like, you know, that was the point, I think, at which really it started. You knew that you were watching, you were there for one of those moments where, and they don't come as much, you know, as often as they used to, because of the fracturing and the gradual, you know, fracturing of the pop culture landscape around demographics, where everybody knew what something was.
Yeah.
You know, and that was just like, it was weird talking to your parents about South Park.
Yeah. I mean, it was more weird the fact that they managed to turn the Mr. Hankey song into a single over here.
Yeah. Oh my God. Seriously?
Yeah. It was, I mean, this was a top 10 single. Mr. Hanky the Christmas Pooh.
They released
he loves
as a
me
Christmas
and he loves you.
Oh my god.
I mean, it's really fitting that we obviously you chose this one because the episode itself is obviously based. The town of South Park has decided they're going to ban religion and they're going to do a nativity which is not offensive to anyone. And the whole, essentially, the joke is the fact that they're constantly censoring and censoring until they end up with this like interpretive dance scene which no one likes anyway. And
with,
obviously, Mr. Hanky is.
I want to point out music by noted minimalist composer Philip Glass.
And obviously, Mr. Hanky's there to, for whatever reason, bring back the Christmas spirit. And he does this by appearing only to Kyle, who then gets diagnosed as being a clinically depressed vicophiliac and Prozac, and committed. I mean, it's essentially just a dirtier version of that Warner Brothers cartoon where the guy's got the frog and it sings and it dances and he tries to show people and it's just like dead.
Yeah, yeah.
It's essentially the same thing here, just with a piece of poo.
Yes. It's the scatological version I can't remember the name of that. I know the one you're talking about, Michigan J. Frog. And there's so much in there. I mean, it basically starts off as a parody of the iconic scene in Charlie Brown Christmas where Linus recites the passage, from the New Testament about the angel visiting Mary. And, you know, it just kind of goes upward from there. It really, there's several scenes in this episode that really play parody. The one with the snowflakes, where they're catching the snowflakes on their tongue, and then there's the bird, and it takes a crap in Kenny's mouth, and then Cartman claims that Kyle can't get Kretz Christmas on his tongue because he's a Jew, and Officer Bart Brady determines it's against the law. You just don't know. You have that was the excitement of watching South Park. You would sit there almost terrified and just sit there wondering, it's like, how much further can they take this? I can barely believe I'm seeing this as it is to begin with obvious, you know, parodies of your what we would now call the War on Christmas types over here versus the political correctness police. And you have a second grader singing a song about how another character's mom is a bitch. And
oh yeah, because Kyle's mom's a bitch and she's got
shit. Wow, mom's a big fat bitch, biggest bitch there ever was, you know, something like that. Bitch. Yeah, and it's just I mean, particularly in American culture, that was kind of the rise of this sort of hyper offensiveness.
Yeah.
This heightened sense of offensiveness, which we're really plagued by now in America. I don't think, it's really any coincidence. The other thing that the other big American cultural touchstone, and I shudder to call it an American cultural touchstone, that debuted around this time, 96, 97, was Fox News, you know? And this is really, when I was rewatching it, I was really kind of struck by exactly how things haven't changed in American culture since 97, you know, where you still have this whole sort of hypersensitivity about, you know, anything, you know, recently Bill O'Reilly goes and says that, removing like particularly like religious imagery from a school play version of Charlie Brown Christmas is a tantamount to terrorism, you know, and with a presidential candidate, you know, in the Republican primary, echoing the words of Mr. Garrison when he says, why can't we get rid of all the Mexicans? You know, it's just, I'm like, wow, was this really made 18 years ago? Because really you could make it today.
Yeah.
The only thing being that Philip Glass is dead. You'd have to put someone else in there.
Again, I wouldn't say that would stop them. I mean, you saw did to Chef.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I wouldn't put it past like someone being dead for them to be not touched on parody. I mean, one of the things I want to also bring up, obviously, South Park in its early seasons, one of the running jokes was that Kenny dies in every episode. And it was always a way to find ever new and inventive ways to kill Kenny. This is the only episode that he doesn't die in these early seasons. And
yeah.
They play it up. They have all these moments where you think, oh, Kenny's dead. And it's like, they go to say, you bastard. And he's like, oh, no, wait, he's still all right. And my favorite one has to be where he's sent to get the shark. He's sent to get the star down above a shark tank on a rickety ladder. And you're just sure he's like going to fall in the shark tank. But there, you know, he manages to get the star down and he survives. And at the end, where it just comes up the words at the end and he does his little celebration. I just really love that still.
It's a great little moment. It's a great little moment, and of one of the, I think, the great what the hell moments in early South Park history. Why the hell do they need a live shark for a Christmas day? I mean, for crying out loud.
Yeah. It's never actually explained why they have the shark.
No. But, God.
It's kind of like in Nutcracker 3D, which, again, I discussed in the most recent edition of the MBDS showcase, where you've got the villain who has a shark in a tank, and its sole purpose is to be there so he can kill it to prove how evil he is.
Oh, God.
But, I mean, that's a whole other sack of randomness right there. But, no, I think this episode, despite it being an early season, I think this was really the high point of the first season. Damien, which was the episode afterwards, was equally good, but I think this was really sort of the high point of the season, and the last few kind of tailed off towards the end, with obviously like Mecha Barber Streisand, and the really revealing who Cartman's father was.
Yeah, the two episodes, really, there's kind of like a streak of episodes. I don't remember Damien very well, but Tom's rhinoplasty and Mecha Streisand I remember very well. I don't know how well I would have liked Mecha Streisand if I wasn't a gigantic Cure fan.
Yeah.
But I remember the single funniest moment, what I will always remember is the single funniest moment to me, at least in all of South Park, is the post nose job Mr. Garrison, where they basically take his head and they replace it with the head of David Hasselhoff and they just animate the mouth. And I just remember watching that and cracking up. It was the funniest thing I had ever seen in my life. It didn't matter what Mr. Garrison said. David Hasselhoff's face and that sort of kind of like high-pitched, effete, nebbishy voice of Mr. Garrison coming out. And there were a couple lines that sounded really great coming out. It's like, I get to do what I always wanted, which is hang around and screw hot chicks. Or, oh, that's an even more heroin. But it's just, yeah, this is, like I said, the moment for South Park. Right here. This is the point at which you realize you're not watching a flash in the pan.
Yeah.
You realize what I'm watching, this is real. The people who are doing this, they are doing it to create shock value. They're doing that to create shock value. When you have an animated piece of crap bouncing around a bathroom, writing Noel on the mirror, and showing up in things like the, I don't remember the guidance counselor's name, but it's showing up in his cup of coffee, you know. I can never remember his name. Okay. But I think this was, I think, one of his first appearances. I don't remember if he appeared before this, but this was just, you know, yes, they were going, it was like a punk thing. Yes, you realize they were going in it to shock, but there's intelligence behind it. There's something to say.
Yeah.
You know, it really, I think that's one point that it really kind of hit me. These people are not just doing it. They're not just flinging dung at the walls. you know, for the, you know, for the sake of it. And I think the thing that really hits me is my absolute favorite part of the episode, which is the live action insert, the Mr. Hankey, build your own Mr. Hankey kit.
Oh, yes, when that first comes on, I thought that there was something wrong with the TV when that first happened, because it comes out of nowhere. The live action scene, the build your own Mr. Hankey kit, where he comes with a net and it's like Mr. Potato Head, but oh god,
yeah, and it's basically timed, you know, for broadcast on a commercial network. It's perfectly timed. You think you're watching the commercial break, you know, that's the thing. The only little thing that idea that you have at the beginning that you're not watching a genuine commercial, you know, is the little Comedy Central logo on the screen. But yeah, and it's just like the whole big event, just out of nowhere, the little girl's line, I wish Daddy was still alive.
Oh.
And you know, you just realize that you're in almost this heightened realm of comedy.
Yeah. Well, I mean, here in the UK, I said this is shown on Channel 4, so there's no logo in the corner to tell you what it is. There's no watermark there, so I say it just came completely out of nowhere. And somehow they managed to keep bringing Mr. Hankey back. He's not just a one-episode joke. He's made numerous appearances. Normally as this spirit of good and upholding sort of like moral beliefs, which is a weird thing to say about a talking piece of poo, but we get to see his family, and including his special son who's got a peanut in his head.
That's really all I've got to say is
I would say I think we've covered everything on this one. I mean, for a 30 minute cartoon, there's a lot going on in this one. If you're only watching key episodes of the first season, then this would definitely be one.
Right.
I'm not sure I would watch it as a Christmas special, but it certainly works as that if Peekophilia is your thing, I guess.
And it does teach you the spirit of Christmas.
Yep.
It's about presents. No, wait, that's from the video Christmas cards. Never mind.
It's why you don't play with Mookie Stinks.
Yes, Mookie Stinks. Okay.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break. When we return, though, we're going to be looking at our second South Park Christmas special of the evening. We're going to be finding out just how you managed to go from talking poo and managed to make something even more shocking as we look at the Woodland Critter Christmas from Season 8.
Alright guys, so we need to record our top 3 reasons why you should listen to French Toast Sunday podcast.
Number 3 should definitely be our diverse opinions.
Number 2 should probably be our top 3 lists that we do every week.
No, it's gotta be Mark Wahlberg.
What about Gwyneth Paltrow's head?
It's gotta be Fighting the Sadness in the Swamp of Sadness.
Full Frontal.
Stories about being lost at sea.
Brendan Fraser being underground.
Helen Mirren's boobs.
Baltimore accents as heard in The Wire.
Wunderklaus.
Crepes?
Character studies.
Wait, guys. What about movies?
No.
Tree rape.
Tree rape? Yeah, I like tree rape.
Tune in every Friday for a new episode of French Toast Sunday podcast, brought to you by us at FrenchToastSunday.com.
Clothing made out of Burger King wrappers.
Still joining me as always is my co-host, Mr. Daniel Lackey.
Howdy! Okay, I'm going to stop that.
Well, you still got, like, vocal cords.
Yeah, well, I still got a voice, and while you're not sick of me telling you how nice and flowery you smell.
Tell me, it's like, well, we're now in UK time here, we're just past midnight. As I was saying before we came on, due to various issues here, I've essentially been on the go since about 4 o'clock this morning, so I don't think flowery would be the way I would describe how I smell right now. So,
yeah, and I know I'm not going to end the night because I'm seeing the latest showing of Force Awakens tonight. I'm got going to see that at 1:45 a.m. my local time, so I'm sure I'm not going to be particularly flowery smelling by the end of that.
Oh, but you, at least with Star Wars fans, I mean, there are so many that are seemingly allergic to soap and water, so you can kind of get away with letting yourself go when you go to some of these things, so...
Yeah, you know, it's just like, I'll just say, you know, it's a cosplay thing. I'm going as a Wookiee.
Yeah, I've been using that as a spoiler as well. I've been telling everyone that in this one, we're going to find out that Chewbacca is Luke's father.
The ones I've been saying, sharing, other than the picture of the sports car spoiler with the Star Wars logo on it, which I thought was hilariously clever, is Kylo Ren, you know, turns out to be old man Jenkins, and he would have gotten away with it too if it hadn't been for those meddling kids.
Obviously, just one last thing on the Star Wars. If you are in the collectibles market, the one piece of collectibles I would urge everyone to check out is a one-sheet poster that was produced by J.J. Abrams, and it's a play on the World War II and World War I sort of motivation posters. And it's a play on the loose lips sink ships, but he's changed it to loose lips stink sink. Sorry. Loose lips sink starships. And from what I've heard, and this is going off what Kevin Smith has said, he apparently created this because Kevin Smith got invited to the set and all the production team was like basically pointing to posters. He's like, you know, he put that up for you after what you did to episode 3. But there are two variations of it. You got one with Vader essentially strangling a naval officer, and there's the rarer one, which I believe was only on set, which is the Millennium Falcon. I see these being like real big collector's items, and it looks awesome if you can get one and get it framed. So while you may not get an original one, hopefully someone's going to do some reproductions, because I think this is one of the nicer posters to come out of this movie, certainly.
There's another one that says, don't have a mouth like a sarlacc. I'm not sure whether that's an official one or not, but I did see that. Someone shared an image of that on Facebook today. Keep our secrets. Don't have a mouth like a sarlacc.
Yeah. Obviously, our second South Park Christmas special, this is from season 8, and it's the Woodland Critter Christmas. Now, at this point, the gloves are essentially off for South Park. There is no sacred lamb that won't be slaughtered by Matt and Trey. They will basically do anything because essentially they're now at this point untouchable. People know what South Park is. It's the same as when Tarantino describes his films, that he can get away with more because people don't go into a Tarantino movie expecting like a family movie. It's, as he most memorably put it, it's like you don't turn up to a Metallica concert and ask them to turn it down. And essentially the same could be said with South Park here. And here they really go all out, and in the episode, Stan is tricked by a group of satanic woodland creatures into killing the mountain lion that will allow them to summon the Antichrist. And this is all done with a nice, jolly, sort of traditional Christmas voiceover about the boy in the red pom-pom hat. And I watched this, I think, a couple of years ago with my wife. I sat down and it's like, oh, watch South Park, you know, this would be funny. And it got to the halfway point, and I had my head in my hands, and you know those moments where you just, like, wish that a deep hole would appear in the ground and swallow you up? I think that would not do justice to how bad I was feeling as to what this episode actually covers. But, Lucky, had you actually seen this one before I showed it you this week?
No. When you mentioned Woodland Critter Christmas episode, I'm like, oh, this is a little bit after my time, and it's like, I can just see how many blasphemous different directions these people can go.
Yeah.
I went into it expecting, I think, almost something along the lines of Happy Tree Friends. And not really knowing what to expect, having avoided as many plot points as I could, I knew that they spoil in the Hulu description of the episode, they spoil the satanic bit.
Yeah.
Which I wish they hadn't done that. Because if I had not gone into the episode knowing that, I probably would have picked my jaw off at the floor at that particular revelation. And that really comes on the heels of the killing of the mountain lion who's got three cubs.
Oh.
And it is a testament to how well this show works is that I'm a cat person. I was practically in tears for the poor little mountain lion cubs. I mean, they were just so, and just the voices, they voice cast those roles so perfectly.
They're so sad.
They're just so sad. And I'm like, oh damn it, Stan, how you let them trick you. It's like, oh God.
But I mean, the lead up to this, as I said before, we got this jolly little voiceover, and it's like we had Porcupiney the Porcupine and Rabbity the Rabbit, these like really cliche cutesy names. And then we obviously had the first twist that, you know, these are actually Satanists. But I think even if you go into this knowing this Satanist, it barely touches about how depraved this episode gets.
Yes.
Let me say, because we obviously have the mountain lion who gets killed, which we soon find out is the reason that they're not able to summon the Antichrist, because the mountain lion turns up and kills the Antichrist whenever they try to throw this satanic sort of festival. But we have them doing a animal sacrifice. Rabbit the Rabbit is sacrificed by his fellow animals, and he does this willingly, as we added. And then they're devouring his entrails and coating themselves in blood, and then descend into a blood orgy.
Having a blood orgy. I want to point that out. South Park cut out little woodland animals having sex with each other.
Oh, they cut it out on your one. On mine, they were...
No. The cardboard cutout style. Oh, they left it in. Dear God, they left it in. And I'm just literally sitting here saying to myself, you know, I shouldn't be asking myself, am I really watching this? But I am. I am asking, can they really get away with this? And I know I should not be asking this question, because for the last 18 years, I have lived in a world that had South Park in it. Okay, I know even when I didn't watch the episodes, I had a vague idea of every so often what goes on, like the Mohammed one, or Tom Cruise, or Chef. Okay, I know that there is nothing sacred to Trey Parker and Matt Stone, and I love them for that. Okay, this the idea of reverence is not in their dictionary. In fact, I think they're missing the entire volume of that dictionary that has the R's in it. But yet I'm still seeing myself, it's like, good Lord, how could they get away with this? It's a fucking wooden critter blood orgy.
Yeah. And, I mean, that's in itself is shocking enough. I mean, the fact you're watching these cutesy animals engage in graphic sex covered in blood is sort of like shocking enough. And then, of course, we find out that we've got the Immaculate Conception of the Antichrist. And what Stan has to do is to enlist the orphan cubs. And how are they going to defeat the Antichrist? By learning how to do abortions. So they go to the abortion clinic to learn how to do abortions. And the abortionist is there happily. It's Christmas Eve. I've got plenty of abortions for you to help me with.
This is what I absolutely want to know. What the hell is it about Christmas time that makes it prime season for abortions?
That
is like, there's this sort of weird implication in there. You know, just the way he says it, it's like that somehow Christmas Eve is like the busiest time of year for abortion.
The fact is that abortion, I would say, is one of the last big taboos that you have in modern society. And it's a subject that we don't like talking about. And certainly it's one that was covered in great detail and probably one of the best documentaries on the subject with Tony Kaye's Lake of Fire documentary, which essentially presents the argument in a very graphic and interesting way. Interesting is the right word to say, but certainly the word abortion sends a horrible sort of chill. And the fact that we're going to go and hang out at the abortion clinic. And as I said, this is the point where my head and my hands and my wife's wondering, going, what the hell are you watching? It was not a comfortable moment, I can tell you that.
No, it's one of those things where it's like, I don't know if I could ever watch this episode with anybody. No. I would have to watch this episode on my own because, as you may know, Elwood, abortion is quite the touchy subject, not in just in the United Kingdom, but indeed in the United States.
Oh, certainly so. I would say more so certainly in the States that we've recently had. I think there was a shooting recently at a clinic.
Yeah, at a well. Kind of a long story, but basically a conservative group put together an edited video basically meant to falsely indicate that one of the big I know this is going to sound horrible, but family planning franchises was basically doing stuff with aborted fetuses that they were not.
Yeah.
And this has been really picked up by a lot of politicians and thoroughly, you know, turned into talking points and people, you know, driving their planks of their, you know, we're leading up to an election next year, a presidential election, and in particular several candidates basically kind of hammering in this down, you know, this idea that, you know, Planned Parenthood is selling baby parts. And kind of as a result of that, when somebody went and shot up a Planned Parenthood clinic saying no more baby parts. Yeah, we're really, I can't say that we're more sensitive about it than other Western countries. I don't know for sure, but it is a topic here where, you know, I have friends, I can't, you know, we mentioned Black Christmas and Black Christmas, the movie, and White Christmas, the Black Mirror episode. And there are friends I can't watch those episodes with because abortion's a plot point, you know, and I have to pause the episode or whatever we're watching so we can have an argument about it. You know, it's one of the hottest hot button issues right now.
Yeah.
And again, this episode's use of it is again one of those examples of how things, the more things change, the more they stay the same. It, again, you know, you wouldn't think, if you were American, didn't know any better. You wouldn't think this episode was 11 years old. It's still that reflective of stuff that just simply does not seem to change in American culture. Yeah. And in Western culture.
It certainly shocks me, the fact that it's been that long since it originally came out, but it still has a very nasty edge to this episode, yet at the same time, it still has moments which are generally funny. It's not all shock and awe. There are moments which are generally funny, such as the fact that Kyle gets brought into this, and he takes on he allows the Antichrist to possess him so that the Jews can take over Christmas.
Well, because the important plot point is that, well, they Porcupine gives birth to the Antichrist, but the Antichrist's soul cannot survive in that little porcupine body.
Yeah.
They have to find a human host for it to survive, and they need an unbaptized person. So, of course, Kyle would just wander into the narrative.
I think you've obviously been bombarded with all this, and then we obviously have Kyle trying to take over Christmas by being possessed by the Antichrist. And then we cut to Mr. Garrison's class, and it turns out that this is a story being read by Cartman, with the message on the board saying, "Bring a Christmas story." And I'm thinking, what sort of teacher would not question this story at any point?
And the answer to that is Mr. Garrison. It's not like this show has ever gone to any length to try to establish Mr. Garrison as a even remotely competent teacher with a sense of anything resembling responsibility. This is the sort of thing where it's like, bring a Christmas story, and then Cartman brings this in, and nobody stops. He goes on for a good 20 minutes and nobody stops him. Yep, we're in Mr. Garrison's class.
Yeah. I mean, the fact it's Cartman as well gives us that leeway.
Yes.
Because it's like when you have the idiot character say something offensive. You know, because the character's an idiot. It's not like if you have your main character make like a racist statement, for example.
You know, it's not like the You know, it's not like the sequel to Kill a Mockingbird here. Yeah.
You have that leeway because, you know, Carmen's an idiot. He's, you know, he's just the spoiled fat kid who says whatever he wants because no one tells him different.
He's pure. Eric Cartman is pure racist, hateful id. You know, he is everything dark about Western culture, American culture, and he has no capacity to filter what he says. He has none whatsoever. So it is of absolutely no surprise that the worst, basest, most hateful things, shocking things, disgusting things, come out of his mouth. When that cut happens and this is revealed to be Cartman's Christmas story, you're just like, well, that explains everything.
But there's no real warning of it, because we see Stan constantly argue with the narrator.
Which is my favorite part. Not even that he's really arguing with the narrator, but just the narrator is kind of passively aggressively trying to push the narrative forward. Yeah. And Stan is simply not having it. And that's just some of the things that, like, when he's sitting there watching the Jeffersons and saying, nope, I'm not going. You know, it's like, and then the narrator keeps saying, but then he realized, and finally they just cut to him standing at the abortion clinic holding the three mountain lion cubs, and he's like, oh, fuck. You know, it's just like, I don't know. Those, to me, I think of all the weird things that happen in this episode, his kind of resistance to the narrator is, I think, my favorite. That and the woodland critters showing up in his bed.
Hi,
Danny. That was just, oh god. But yeah.
But the fact he's constantly called the boy in the red poofball hat.
Yeah, there's this, much like Mr. Hankey plays off of Charlie Brown Christmas, there are bits where Woodland Critters plays off the Grinch. There's definitely a little bit of a Seussian meter to the verse at points, to the narrator's dialogue. Yeah. And in particular, the mountain lion, the death of the mountain lion, the cave, all of that, the mountain, the cliff is very much built like the Grinch's cliff in the original cartoon. It's something, again, it's not as obvious. The references aren't as obvious as they are in Mr. Hankey, but to someone familiar with the Grinch, you know what you're seeing.
It's I love the fact that when we do see the Antichrist, he reminds me so much of the Spider Monkey from Brain Dead.
Yeah, yeah. It's just this little, like, furry thing, thing, you know.
So, and the ending as well, it just makes me think that they'd reached this point where they had no idea how to end this. So basically, their go-to plan is Santa turns up and shoots them all with a shotgun.
Yeah, but that's really not entirely out of character for Santa, you know, as far as South Park is concerned.
But in that respect, it reminds me a whole bunch of Infinite Santa 8000, which is a YouTube series, well worth checking out. I know the director of, again, he was recently on an episode of the Feminine Critique where he was talking about the series and his favorite holiday memories and holiday specials. So whenever I see Santa packing a shotgun in South Park, my mind instantly goes to that show as well. But the fact he turns the death of the Antichrist into a Gallagher joke is just the real highlight here. Not the fact he's pulling heads off. The fact that the Antichrist is turned into a Gallagher joke just really sort of tops it off. And then we obviously find out that Cartman's not so happy at giving a happy ending, so he kills Kyle with AIDS.
Everybody lived happily ever after, except Kyle, who died of AIDS 2 weeks later.
So, and then it ends. And we have the nice Christmas song, and Kyle angrily saying, "God damn it, Cartman."
You know, this is just... It's all the things I think that makes South Park the cultural touchstone it is. this is South Park knowing how satire, how to make a certain form of satire work by making you very uncomfortable. You know, this is cringe comedy.
It's something.
It's definitely, to me, this is almost what this particular style of comedy is for. You know, you can basically address a lot of the absurdity of things by dressing it up as like cringe comedy.
Yeah.
And just by having things there, there's a line, I don't remember the entire context, but it's a line about, well, you know, it's like where the whole time thing is, of course, about the reveal, the satanic reveal, is that that doesn't come till about halfway through the episode. They keep talking about their Lord and Savior being born to Porcupine, but, you know, Stan assumes that it's the Son of God, and somebody points out the obvious. Can't be the Son of God, because would God ever have sex with a porcupine?
Yeah.
You know?
It's certainly a fair comment. You're watching this, and I remember watching the South Park film Bigger, Longer, and Cut, and guiltily laughing at what we thought was like the most risque joke in there, where the army's going to war against Canada, and their plan is to basically put all the black votes in front of the white folks in the operation Get Behind the Darkies. And I remember thinking, oh, that's like a really risque joke. And like, how do you top that? But where that line is, that the line is just a blur when you compare that to Will and Christmas. It's, I don't know how they can top it. I mean, they brought back Dead Steve Irwin in the Hell on Earth special, so is there ever going to be a limit? Because at the moment, it seems like they're untouchable. They're basically making the show as long as they want to be making it, because it costs so little to make.
Right.
It still has so that rabid cult following.
You know, it costs so little to make, it gets, they turn it out so quickly, and it still has a following.
Yeah.
You know, I know people, I think my kind of trajectory with South Park is the same, you know, trajectory that a lot of people kind of went through. You know, I was kind of there at the beginning, and then I was there for a while, and then it's like, okay, I've kind of had my fill of this. This is not something I can watch every week anymore. And again, a lot of it also kind of tying in with that was that, you know, this was the, you know, the late 90s with American television. We're definitely not adjusted to watching, you know, a show that's 30 minutes long and has only 10 episodes a season and has an irregular production schedule. You can't always, you know, you lose touch. You know, that was the pre-DVR era, you know, and even at that point you're taping shows, but you've got, you know, with the fragmentation and cable just getting so many more and more and more and more channels that you can't really tape everything anymore.
Yeah.
Unless you got 5 VCRs. So after a while, you kind of fall out with, you know, you kind of, you know, drift away. I kind of drifted away from it after season 2, or really after the movie. And I kind of felt like, okay, it's time to move on to something else. But what really kind of happened there was that, you know, it hit that kind of cultural saturation point, and it was never going to be, from that point forward, never going to be as popular as it was at that point, but it found its audience. It found its core audience, and its core audience stuck with it. So that after the rest of us dilettantes drift away and dabblers drift away from it, you know, the diehards, the people that it's really speaking to, they stick with it. And I have several friends, good friends, who have stuck with South Park all these years. You know, to them, you know, they don't get sick of it. To them, it's as fresh and, you know, as vital as it ever was. You know,
yeah.
I was going somewhere with that. I don't remember. but yeah, that was like, you know, I don't know if Parker and Stone have limits. Their only limits are really kind of self-imposed. They got some flack over the picture of Muhammad. They got some flack from Comedy Central, and there was a lot of blowback there. But I think that maybe some of the Scientology stuff might have really been the only time that Comedy Central has ever really stepped in or at least that I can see, that I've ever heard about Comedy Central saying, stepping in a very visible way and saying, no, you can't do this. This is beyond the pale, you know, and that's, in many ways, that's a good thing for Comedy Central. They have that kind of hands-off attitude towards it, you know, because then that's part of its selling point. It's part of the selling point is these guys have no sacred cows. They hold nothing dear. There is nothing off limits for them. Anything which strikes them as ridiculous or absurd in culture, they will target it.
Yeah. It's and these aren't dumb guys. I mean, these are very sort of switched on. So guys, I love the fact that they use South Park as their base and they use it as a way to do other projects. I mean, they did obviously Basketball off the end of it, one of the great sporting comedies. And more recently, they've done The Book of Mormon over on in the theaters, which again is receiving rave reviews, and Team America World Police again.
That could be, by the way, that could be one of the only time I've heard the words basketball, one of the great sporting movies ever assembled in that order.
I would say so. Let's name the great sporting movies. I mean, obviously, what? We got Slapshot. Where'd you really go? I mean, what we got left? We got like The Sandlot.
Bad News Bears, The Sandlot, Field of Dreams.
Okay, can you name one that's not a baseball movie?
Friday Night Lights. I don't really know. The Miracle. I don't know, because, you know, the mythology, as Americans, we just mythologize baseball to a ridiculous degree. The Wrestler.
The Wrestler is, I feel that that's something that we'll probably, because of what it would take to go into, and I could probably just sit here and talk for hours about The Wrestler. Being a wrestling fan, The Wrestler really paid homage and was so respectful to the sport that I love and adore. And showed it what it was, and explained in a way to people who thought the wrestling, oh, it's just fake, there's no athleticism. And it showed that, like when you have the scenes where they're preparing for the matches and what this idea of this fading star, and the fact he's been reduced to wrestling in like bingo holes and that, and it being how true it is to a lot of these, especially like 90s wrestlers, where you see like guys like Jake the Snake Roberts in Beyond the Mat, and he's like hooked on crystal meth and like, basically wrestling for like 12 people in a hole somewhere just so he can fund his drug habit and stuff. And I think The Wrestler certainly touched on that. But yeah, basically, I think we were naming favorite sports movies all the time. I still remember like sitting at one Christmas Eve, it was a late night showing. Me and my brother just watching it and think this was just like the most hysterical film we'd ever seen.
I wouldn't really call it. It's not. They really didn't write. Really have any. They starred in it.
Yeah.
This was about the height of their fame. That's more of a kind of like a post Airplane Zucker Brothers.
Yeah.
Type thing. Over here, what we know them for, outside South Park, and there's really as much a cult around this film, as there is around South Park, which is Team America.
Really? I was surprised you said Team America, because I would have thought that you would have like gone for Orgasmo, or to maybe to an extent Cannibal the Musical.
Orgasmo has its fans. Cannibal the Musical has its fans, but there is a specific, really a very particular cult around Team America. You know, I have friends who refer to July 4th, Independence Day, as America Fuck Yeah Day.
This is the great thing about it, because it's essentially satire in America. And
right.
It's the sort of way that we Brits and like outside the UK, we just sort of view America's sort of approach to world peace, that we just like storm in there and like gun everything down. My friend, who for whatever reason has got a grudge against France, loves the opening sequence just because Paris gets decimated. And it's for these reasons as well. He also really likes G.I. Joe as well.
But yeah, Team America, in many ways, Team America is... It's particularly beloved because it really... You know, it's one of the very few things that really kind of effectively satirizes what we as Americans think of ourselves, our own, what we mythologize, our own, the mythology that we've built around ourselves, particularly since we've, you know, deluded ourselves, you know, into believing that we single-handedly won World War II.
Oh, yeah. I wouldn't have minded Saving Private Ryan, the opening, you know, perhaps they'd pan the camera just slightly to the right just to show, you know, the British forces being there as well.
You know, it's like, yeah, let's forget, let's forget everything. Let's forget all of the intelligence, the vital intelligence work, you know, that Britain was doing, you know, and let's forget Russia pretty much holding them, pretty much. holding off the Nazis in Eastern Europe ad infinitum. No, it was all going to shit until we came in. Yeah. You know, that's really the thing that, and Parker, and this is not the only time Parker and Stone have ever played on that. I mean, that's even there in the South Park movie. They really kind of know, they really know how to satirize exactly what we Americans think we are. And I really actually have to say I'm a little bit surprised that the film doesn't have more of a following outside America, you know, where people where people in other countries can see, like, yes, okay, someone over there gets it, you know. there is somebody over there with some self-awareness.
Yeah. I mean, for all the smack that's obviously talked about the States and stuff, you can guarantee that more British people watching American programming than they are British programming.
Yeah.
We've covered numerous
yeah.
times before, so I think it's weird the fact that we're producing programming for American audiences and American programs being essentially produced for UK audiences, because all ever anyone wants to talk about, be it on Netflix, be it on normal sort of TV services, are American projects. So but yeah, I mean, anything else that we're to obviously discuss on Matt and Trey and on South Park in general, really?
Yep.
And then on that note, it sort of brings us to the end of our Christmas special. Hope you've enjoyed listening. Please do let us know on Twitter. You can find us at @TVGoodSleepBad. We're also on the Facebook. Again, just type in @TVGoodSleepBad. You can find us on there as well. Lucky, if people want to obviously read more of your ramblings, movie writings and things, where can they come and find you?
They can find me in my apartment, furiously typing away and talking to myself. You can find me at thenightmaregallery.com, where I review film and television, and I am also a contributor to Cinema Axis, cinemaaxis.com, where I have my own little niche carved out there with my own little writing knife, where I cover genre and cult films and just bizarre things like Goodnight Mommy.
Nice. As for myself, again, as always, you can find me at From the Depths of DVD Hell, which is fromthedepthsofdvdhell.blogspot.co.uk, as well as over at Channel Superhero, which is channelsuperhero.com. Again, all the links can be found in the description section below, so if you missed anything, you can find it all below there as well. But thank you again for obviously listening to the show. If you have enjoyed the show, please do leave us some nice words on iTunes or Podomatic, wherever you happen to be listening. Your stars are our applause. What have we got coming up on the next episode?
You and I had decided to do something a little bit tying in to a certain special thing, which is returning to our screens in January of next year.
Yep.
So related to that, I am doing an episode of Kolchak the Night Stalker, episode 3 of the show's single season, an episode variously titled either UFO or They Have Been, They Are, They Will Be.
As for myself, I'm going to be looking at a classic episode of The X-Files. We're going to be looking at the episode Home, because who really doesn't love inbred redneck mutants? In probably one of the most controversial episodes of the show, and at which point, after they're dead, they basically got the note, don't ever, ever do that again. So I'm really looking forward to discussing that one, and obviously, more importantly, checking out Kolchak, the Night Stalker, which, for any fans of the X-Files, will know it was one of the key influences Chris Carter when he came to create the series. But we've got all that, and we'll obviously have all the usual what we've been watching as well. So make sure you subscribe now, and we will see you in January. Happy holidays.